The title of today's forum is Interest in a Career in Foreign Service. Today's guest is James Bjorkman, Vice Consul at the U.S. Embassy in Managua, Nicaragua, where he works as Immigrant Visa Unit Chief. In this position, he is responsible for adjudicating the visas for all applicants who wish to permanently reside in the United States. James joined the State Department in 2008 as a Presidential Management Fellow with the Office of State Programs, Operations, and Budget, where his team provided high-level budget analysis for department principals, was the primary contact for budget matters for Congress, and oversaw the compilation and production of the Congressional Budget Justification. While in RMBP, James's efforts were rewarded with a Franklin Award and a Meritorious Honor Award. He resigned his fellowship to join the Foreign Service in February 2010. His previous assignments were in Tijuana, Mexico, as a political officer, and to the Office of E-Diplomacy in Washington, D.C., where he served as a business practice advisor on internal collaboration information systems. James holds a Juris Doctor with specialization in public international law from McGeorge School of Law. During his studies, James worked as an intern at the Utah Supreme Court and the UN's International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. James also earned a Bachelor of Arts in Mathematics and a Bachelor of Science in Political Science with specialization in international relations from the University of Utah. James is a movie buff who volunteers at the Sundance Film Festival each January. Please join me in welcoming James.
Kind of funny to hear your life summed up like that, isn't it? All right. Well, today I'd like to have more of a discussion with you than provide for a lecture. So what I'm going to do is give you an intro, a little bit more of an intro to me with some specifics about what I've done, how I got to where I am. And then I'll ask you for some input about what you'd like to hear about, because the last thing I want to do is stand up here and bore you. I know it's after lunch, it's the afternoon, so if you're getting drowsy, we'll try to keep everybody entertained. So as mentioned, I did study political science here at the University of Utah. I got the International Relations Certificate and used that along with my math major to springboard into law school, where I attended in Sacramento, and specialized there in public international law, which is the law of treaties that govern, you know, countries. From there, I started working on budget at the State Department through the Presidential Management Fellowship Program, which is a program that anybody who's in a postgraduate degree program can apply for in their last year. They have positions all over the government. You just have to take a test. If you pass the test, then you're eligible to apply for these hand-picked jobs. So those of you who are in graduate programs or who will be, I encourage you to look a little bit more into that. The website is pmf.gov. After having worked in budget for a little while, I decided that I was more interested in the Foreign Service. I'd rather be working overseas, getting a new job every couple of years, as opposed to staying in the same job kind of indefinitely until I found something new. So I took the Foreign Service exam. Has anybody in here already taken the Foreign Service exam? All right. Okay. Well, if you're over 18 and a U.S. citizen, then you are eligible to take the exam. It is a little difficult. The pass rate is relatively low, so I encourage you to, you know, research it, look into it, and you know, prepare properly if you're going to take it. I'm happy to talk a little bit more about that later on. So most recently I was working as a consular officer in Nicaragua. I just barely finished that job last week. I'm on my way to Guyana in South America, not Africa as many people think, where I'll be working as the political and economic counselor to the ambassador, which is a fancy way of saying that I'll just be doing political and economic reporting, writing cables on those topics. While I was in Nicaragua, I had two different jobs. One was already described, the Immigrant Visa Unit Chief, and then I was also the American Citizen Services Officer for a year. So basically any American that ended up in Nicaragua in trouble, you know, they got robbed, they lost their passport, maybe they got themselves into some legal trouble and were arrested, I was the guy that had to try to help them out. So that ended. I have some interesting stories from that particular experience, let me tell you. We'll get into some of those later as well. So So that's how I arrived at where I am today. Before I kind of jump into the whole, before I start soliciting input from you guys, let me just give you a little bit of a background. The State Department Foreign Service has 5 different types of officers. They're political and economic, which are essentially the same job. It's just a question of topic. So political covers kind of everything that's not covered by economic. So economic covers obviously economic issues, weapons of mass destruction, environmental issues, and just kind of a handful of niche things like that. Consular officers do what I've just briefly described. They work in visas to get people from the local country to the U.S. to visit or to live permanently, and they help Americans who are in that country who find themselves in need of some service. The fourth type is public diplomacy, and those are essentially press people, public relations folks. So they liaise with the local press. They both push stories out that they want covered, and then they also respond to inquiries that come in. So let's say, over the last year, the problems that we've been having in D.C. with budget issues, like a local newspaper in Nicaragua would come to our public affairs officer and ask for some sort of statement or some sort of input or explanation about what's going on. And then the fifth type of officer is a management officer, and they handle the logistical necessities of living overseas and running an embassy. So they do human resources, they do finances, they do motor pool, housing, pretty much anything you can imagine that you would need to function on a day-to-day level. They keep the lights on, they keep the people working, they keep the positions filled. By track, I'm a political officer, so that's where my focus will be as I move forward in my career. But each particular specialty, as you've just heard, has its own kind of set of tasks and interesting aspects that come with that. Aside from the State Department, there are a lot of other federal agencies that work at embassies. Just a handful are USAID, Commerce. We also have Marines stationed at most embassies overseas, Department of Agriculture, FBI, and then a handful of other ones as well. So even if you're not particularly interested in the State Department, there are other avenues to get there if you want to, an exciting life working for the government overseas. So with that brief intro, like I said, I really would like to have more of a conversation with you than just provide a lecture. So is there something that you want to talk about? Anybody have a specific question? Yes, sir, let me start over here.
I've been noticing.
Hold on a second.
I'm Travis Isbell. I was noticing on a lot of the embassy websites in the different countries, they put up job postings, like for instance, security advisor or a consular assistant, mm-hmm. things like that. Are all those jobs postings through the State Department? Do you need to be a Foreign Service officer to apply for those?
No, those are actually what are called locally engaged staff jobs. So as an officer, my headquarters is D.C., and they just send me to a new place every couple of years. Those locally employed staff jobs are permanent in that embassy. So most of those positions are filled by local nationals, so in Nicaragua, Nicaraguans. I happen to know a guy who's an officer that worked in one of those positions in China, in a locally engaged staff position in China, and then use that as kind of a springboard to become an officer. I don't think that's very common, but a lot of people do that. But those jobs are open to anybody who has the legal right to work in that country where the job is posted. Yeah.
Hi, my name's Dane. I'm pursuing a Bachelor of Arts in Economics, and I just actually have a few questions. First of all, could you talk about just sort of what types of experiences you should be trying to gain during both undergrad and if you go on to grad school? Mm-hmm. And also, could you talk about types of things you should be doing for test prep?
Yes. So I'm going to answer the second part first, test prep. There's a lot of I'll call it rumor out there that to prepare for the test, you should be reading The Economist and the New York Times and, you know, studying an atlas and all this stuff. The fact of the matter is that the written test has, you know, a few different portions, and only one of those portions is what's called job knowledge. And within that job knowledge section, there are a bunch of different types of questions. So some of it is, well, the questions are what I would consider to be trivial pursuit questions. So, you know, one sample question I've seen is, who was the first African American poet to read at a presidential inauguration? Well, I don't know that offhand. Right, I don't know how many of you know that offhand, but, you know, it's pretty kind of obscure stuff. Some of it is a little bit more specific to the State Department and the work that we do internationally, like, for example, you know, what continent is Guyana on? So, there are also kind of management type questions, like what's the best way to motivate an employee? Threaten them, you know, beat them up, offer them constructive criticism, you know? So, hopefully we could all get that one right. But yeah, like I said, that's just one section of the test, and even that is just such a smattering of information. There's not really one thing that you could study. But the one thing you're guaranteed to have questions on is the Constitution. So my one specific concrete piece of advice is to read the Constitution probably a couple of times, and once within a couple of days of the exam. Before I get to your first question, let me talk just a little bit more about the exam. For those of you who don't know, it's a four-stage process. Well, I'll call it a five-stage process, actually, to get into the Foreign Service. First is registration, which, as our friend in the back of the room knows, is not an easy step. It's not, you're not getting tested, but it asks for so much information that a lot of people don't ever finish that part of the testing process. They just get kind of overwhelmed, forget about it, they don't have the time for it. So it does take hours to just fill out the registration. Once you filled out the registration, then you get the opportunity to take the written test, which we've just been talking about. Like I said, there is a job knowledge section. There's a section on, you know, logic, on grammar. There's an essay that you have to write. There's a biographical section where it asks you kind of what types of jobs you've had in the past, what you've done, what experiences you've had. And that's actually the hardest section. Most people don't get that because they just think, oh, it's biographical, I don't need to know anything. But it'll ask you questions like, how many jobs have you had in customer service? Well, if you're sitting there with every question, you know, counting on your fingers, okay, well, I worked at Pizza Hut, Burger King, you know, Wells Fargo Bank, whatever it is, you're not going to have enough time to answer all the questions, because once you click an answer on almost all those questions, a text box pops up and it asks you to describe something. What were your tasks in that job? Name the jobs, you know, whatever it might be. So that's a section to not underestimate. So one other tip is to know your resume backwards and forwards when you go in. If you pass that section, which somewhere in the vicinity of about half the people do, then you're invited to submit some narratives. They're called personal narratives. And they ask you questions like, you know, describe an experience where you showed leadership. You know, describe an experience where you showed initiative. You know, tell me about a time that you solved a difficult problem. And they're limited in the number of characters that you're allowed to submit, so it is pretty tough to craft an answer that you think covers what they want to know in a relatively small space. You submit that along with your resume, and the next evaluation of you is what's called the QEP, the Qualification Evaluation Panel. And that's actually the hardest portion of the test. This statistic is years old because that was when I took the test, but a few years ago, about 25% of the people passed that portion. So what they're looking for there is just you meet kind of the minimum qualifications to do this job, which will lead me into your first question. One second. You know, if you have, you know, just graduated, you don't have any kind of internship experiences, well, let's say you haven't even graduated yet, then maybe they might not think that you have the experience that you would need to serve as a competent officer over the span of a career yet. That's what happened to me when I was in law school. I applied for the first time, and that was a step that I did not pass. But there are ways to kind of get the experience that you think you might need. Honestly, the best experience you could have would be to work for the State Department. If you can get an internship, whether that's in D.C. or overseas, that's the best way. And honestly, I think that's the only reason that I passed the test the second time I took it, was because I knew the language that they speak at the State Department. And there are a lot of really peculiar things there. Like, for example, one of the most commonly used phrases is not/not. which means really not, like definitely not. I don't know, don't ask me. So I refuse to use it, so that's going to limit where I can go in my career. But another one is, this is soonest. Soonest means just most urgent task, you know, what you've got to do right away. So there are kind of some peculiar things, a lot of acronyms, just a lot of unique language. So having that experience and that background, I think, is something that's really helpful to passing that portion of the test. And it also helps when you get to the third section of the test, which is the oral assessment. So if you pass the QEP, then you're invited to a full day-long battery of tests. In that, they test you in a group exercise where everybody has a project that they're trying to fund, and as a group, you're the committee that's going to decide what projects will be funded. So your job is to advocate for your own project, but there's not enough money to fund more than maybe one or two of the projects. So you kind of, it's an exercise in negotiation, and then, you know, obviously some people have to bow out at some point, so it's kind of a question of how best to do that. You know, like, my project really isn't the greatest, you know, this other project over here is to help, you know, help treat people that have AIDS in the local country so they can, you know, live longer and happier lives. My project is to, build a chain link fence for this chicken farm down the street. Well, I think the AIDS one might be a little bit more appropriate, but it's kind of like, well, how do you decide to kind of bow out of that? So you say, well, I believe this program might help. This program would help more people in the country. It's more urgent. People are dying, so I think that we should probably do this program instead of mine. But again, that's just a whole. It's just a question of the type of group you have too. It's a very, very kind of fluid and interesting section of the test. The second section is an interview where you have two current Foreign Service officers. Usually, they're more senior people, and they interview you. They ask you both substantive questions like, describe a time when you show leadership like you did on the narratives earlier in the process, or tell me about a particularly difficult customer you had one time. They also ask you some hypothetical questions, like, you are a consular officer in Zimbabwe and you get a phone call that a civil war has started in the south of the country. What do you do? Like, well, I don't know. So, you know, maybe find out some more information. You know, so basically you kind of answer the best you can, and then they evolve the hypothetical, making it more and more difficult as you go along until you finally end up at a place where you're going to have to make a tough choice and there's not really a right answer. But so, again, it's a question of explaining why you've decided the way you did and why you think it's the best option. And then the third part of that oral assessment is a writing a memo. So you'll get a big packet of information and then a prompt, like, the ambassador wants you to write a memo about, you know, this particular staff grievance. Like, there's a disagreement between two staff members. Here's like the file of all their emails back and forth, reports of them yelling at each other. Like, so you have to write, you have to go through this tremendous amount of information and then write a concise memo giving your recommendation and explaining why. So if you pass that part, then you're invited to get your medical clearance and your security clearance. Once you have those, then you're on what's called the register, which is rank ordered by the score that you got on the oral assessment. So even if you've made it all the way to that point, then you still might not get hired. Because, for example, over the last year, with all the budgetary problems we've been having, there's been a lot less hiring. So if you scored, you know, let's say you barely passed, or even if you passed kind of in the middle of the group, the hiring might not take enough people off the top of those lists to get down to your position. So it is a very competitive process to get there, which is why it's to your benefit to get some experiences that would help you prepare for it. So again, coming back to your question, I think the best experience is to just get actual experience with the State Department. If you can make that happen, there are internships all over the world. Some of them are paid, some of them are not. There are internships in D.C. as well. So there are a lot of ways to get in there. There are also student programs. So like the way that I got into the State Department, the Presidential Management Fellowship Program, I got in there after I finished school, and then it was, again, I swear that it was because of the experience that I had being in the State Department already that I was able to pass the test that second time that I took it. Some other good experiences that you might look for are working for, you know, NGOs, you know, somewhere internationally if you can. Basically getting some sort of experience that you think would be using in the track that you're applying for. So if you are you know, you're a public diplomacy enthusiast. Well, then maybe looking for jobs in PR locally, looking for, you know, opportunities to work in the press even might help. If you want to be a management officer, then, you know, working in a business, working in the, like the logistical kind of administration side of a business, that would be very helpful to getting there. So again, it's really, you got to tailor your experience to kind of what you have in mind. And there is no one right answer. And I think the only wrong answer would be to not do anything. So, because every experience really, it really is what you make of it. So even if it's something you don't think might, that you don't think would have a good impact, I mean, if you do a good job and you get some good experiences from that, you even get some good references, then, you know, I would encourage you to just make the most of whatever situation you're in.
Hi, my name is Kevin Wong, and you were saying earlier that you have different jobs, like you never stay like in one place. Does that mean that like you do different things in different areas, or do you have the same basic like job title? And also, who assigns like where you go? Do you get to pick that, or and like what projects you do?
Okay. Again, I'll answer the last part first because it's the easiest. The projects that you'll do is just assigned by your supervisor, but that's going to be kind of within the scope of the job that you have. And State Department tours are either 1, 2, or 3 years, depending upon where you're going. One, basically, the worse the job is, the less time you have to spend there. So Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, Yemen, and those are all shorter tours. Even places like Cuba, that's a 2-year tour, but most places in the world are 3 years. There are options to extend that time or curtail the time if you have some kind of compelling reason why you don't think it's going to work out. When you join the Foreign Service, you enter an orientation class, which is colloquially known as A100. In A100, everybody in your group is bidding on jobs that are on a list of kind of what's available. So in my case, I had 95 people in my class. We had a list of, I think it was 103 or so places. And everybody in my class had to go through that whole list and either put high, medium, or low preference on all of those jobs. And then give three sentences kind of why I bid the way that I bid. And that's what the process is called, is bidding. So for me, my wife was pregnant. We wanted to be kind of closer to the U.S. I didn't want to spend a lot of time in D.C. because I'd already been living there when I was working in budget. And I can't remember what the third one was, but those were my reasons. So I ended up in Tijuana because I'm from Utah, you know. It's, you know, like a day drive from here to there. Long day, but nonetheless, you could do it in a day. So, you know, other people have different things. Like they speak, you know, they speak some particular language. Like, you know, like they speak Thai and they want to go to Thailand. So they might just bid a couple of things. Like the ones that happen to be in Thailand, those might be the only ones that are top because they really want to go there. It's not very realistic to ask for that because if there's only a couple of spaces, then you might not get it. Timing is also a question, like how much language training you'll need and other training. So, I mean, it's really kind of a complicated process when you get into it. But in A100, that's how it works. And then HR, or human resources people called career development officers, they just tell you where you're going to go. So in my class of 95, I believe there were only 2 people that got a low preference. And the vast majority got a high preference. So they got one of their, you know, top picks. And the 2 people that got low preferences, I believe they both went to Nigeria. So I can't imagine too many people put Nigeria high on their list. But yeah, but those 2 people are still in the service. They both enjoyed their time there. They made the most of it. So once you finish your first tour, which is the first 2 tours are always 2 years. So once you finish your first tour, then you go through this bidding process again. It's just a little bit different because the list is longer because you're bidding with everybody in the department that's at that stage that's finishing their first tour. And so you give a list of, I believe it's 30, your 1 through 30 preferences. You give that to your career development officer. And then it's the same thing. They just come back and tell you where you're going. If you've served in a difficult place the first time, you're more likely to get what you want the second time, and then vice versa. If you serve in Paris the first time, you're probably going to, you know, Mozambique or someplace like that for your second tour. And then after that, then bidding becomes a lot more complicated, which is what I just recently had to do. So the list comes out of all the jobs, and it's for every type of job in the entire department. I think the list this year was, I narrowed it down to people at my pay grade, and then just to reporting positions, so political and economic positions. And the list was, I think, 135 worldwide. What you have to do is you have to pick a job from the list and then convince both the supervisor of that job and the deputy director of the office that oversees that region, but is working in D.C., you have to convince both of those people to hire you for that job. And on top of that, HR has, or the Human Resources Department has to approve it. So most of the time, people agree on a job and there's not a problem, they get it. But there can be reasons why Human Resources might say, no, they need to do this because there are different regulations about how much time you can spend out and all that. So that's how it works. And then once you get to the top of the chain, like when you're, you know, a chief of mission, like an ambassador or a deputy chief of mission, you get more kind of back to the directed area where the bureau will just tell you, hey, we need somebody to go to Belize. So can you go to Belize? So you don't have as much choice. I mean, yeah, they kind of ask you yes or no, but you're going to say yes. So because you wouldn't have gotten to that position if you were saying no to opportunities like that. So, each job on the list is qualified by one of those five cones that I already described. So they'll kind of have a generic, you'll have a general idea of how much you're, like what kind of work you're going to be doing, but then when you get there, you work it out with your bosses to specifically like, what they want you to do. You don't have to know all of them. Everybody in their first two tours has to do a consular tour, so they do visas. A lot of people do consular work for both of their tours, regardless of their track, their career track. But you're bidding on jobs, so you select what you're putting on your list, or when you get to the mid-level, you're contacting the supervisor of the position, trying to tell them that you're good for that job. So. You have to have luck when you're early, when you're getting directed to where you're going, and then you have to have the skills that they're looking for to apply for the job when you get to that mid-level. Yeah. Let me go to the back. There's one back. Is there one back there? Okay, let's hear from Emily because we're working on the mic.
My name's Emily Gorham, and thanks for sharing your tips and experiences. I was just wondering, looking at your background, that you went to law school, and can you explain to us what sparked your interest in international relations and law?
Sure. International relations, I fell in love with it in Model UN in ninth grade. So I was the PLO, which was an interesting position to have. So I was in Model UN all the way through high school, and then got up here to the university and, you know, just kept taking classes and was always interested in what was going on. So what sparked it originally was Model UN, and I just kind of never lost the taste for it. Law school is a little bit less, how do I put it, less romantic, I guess. As I was finishing school, I didn't know what I was going to do with myself with the poli-sci and math degree, right? And what else? Do more school. So I was looking at options, and kind of a mentor that I had mentioned, well, you know, I heard that math majors do well on the LSAT, you know, the law school admissions exam. So then, all right, well, I'll take it. So I took it, and I scored pretty well and ended up at law school. So that was how it worked out. Yeah.
My name is Maya Farrell. I'm a double major in political sciences and international studies. And I have a question in regards to, you mentioned that you have a baby, you have a family. Mm-hmm. I want to know how hard it is to be in the Foreign Service and have a family. My second question is, if you don't pass the test on the first time, how long do you have to wait to take the test again? And how about moving expenses? Do they help you with that?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, I'm just going to keep answering the last question first all the time. The department moves you. So they pay for the moving company to come pack your stuff up, to ship your car and all that. They pay for your plane tickets. They pay for, you know, two bags. So there's, you know, one set of bags that come free usually, and then you have to pay for the other one. They pay for all that. So kind of ostensibly it seems like it's free, but inevitably, every time you move, you spend a lot of money. Anybody who's even moved locally should probably know that. I mean, you got to replace all your frozen food, your refrigerated food. There's just new stuff you got to buy, like a new curtain rod, a new rug. I mean, there's a lot of expenses that come with it, but the big chunks are covered by the department. Coming back to the family question, how easy or hard it is really depends on your personality. I'm mildly adventurous, I'll say. You know, I'm not a you know, somebody that's going to go, you know, base jump off of a cliff or something. But you know, I like traveling. I like going to other countries. So for me, it hasn't been hard. And then depending upon where you go, the department also pays to send you home during your tour. And again, the harder the place is, the more often they send you back. So Cuba, which I've already mentioned, is a 2-year tour. They send you back 3 times, which comes out to every 6 months, because you arrive, you get a vacation, you know, vacation, but with kids, it's not really a vacation. Anybody who has them can attest to that. So you arrive 6 months later, you get to go home 6 months later, you get to go home 6 months later, you go home, and then 6 months later, you finish your tour. Places like Paris, you don't get any of those trips. So you're on your own. So for you're there for 3 years, if you want to come back to the U.S., you got to pay for it. So it really depends on the place, on how often you get that. But with those kind of regular trips, and then also my parents travel quite a bit, and my wife's parents travel a lot too, so they come visit us. So that's made it easy. I have a fun family situation in that I have twins that just, they're a couple months past 3, and then we have our youngest, which is about to turn 2. So we have 3 kids that are running around crazy, screaming all the time, throwing stuff all over the place. One of the benefits of the Foreign Service is that there are low costs of living in a lot of places we go. So like Nicaragua, which is the second poorest country in the hemisphere, we were able to afford domestic help. So that made our life a lot more enjoyable. We were able to focus time on, you know, playing with our kids, as opposed to having to do the dishes all the time and, you know, mop all the linoleum, or not linoleum, all the tile floors that we had, you know. So we were able to really focus on the family and spend more quality time with them. And I forget your second question, I'm sorry.
You don't pass the test.
Oh, yes. So if you don't pass the first time, the general rule is that you have to wait 1 year to take it again. There are certain programs where you can take it more often than that, but the max is 2x per year, and those programs are by and large limited to people who are already working for the federal government. So again, the general rule is 1x per year, unless you fit a very, very narrow exception. Yeah.
Sorry, my name is Jonathan Lee. I have a question that kind of goes along with hers. Are there any assignments that you'd be sent where they recommend to not bring your family?
Mm-hmm.
And how does that work out, I guess?
Yeah. There are a lot of, they're called unaccompanied tours. And there are actually a lot of tours that are in between. It's a lot of tours where you can't bring school-age children, which means you could bring young children or older children. A lot of them more that are, you can only bring family members that are over 18 years old or over 12 years old. And that's really depends on the place. The two easiest examples are Iraq and Afghanistan. Those are both unaccompanied. So, if you go there, you can't bring your family with you, even if you wanted to, although I hope you wouldn't want to. And then, they send you back. I'm not sure because I haven't done one of those tours, but I think it's you get 3 R&Rs, rest and recuperation trips, during that year. So it's like every 3 months you get to go back home. But, my friends that have done it talk a lot about just doing, you know, FaceTime, Skype type stuff to stay in contact. And it is hard. There are a lot of financial incentives to do that, but, you know, again, it's just a trade-off. So like everything in life, you just have to decide if, you know, the benefits of both the financial incentives as well as the career advancement, because it is career-enhancing to go work there, if those are worth the cost of being away from your family for a year. Some people have it easy. They don't have kids, and both people in the couple are officers, so they'll both go work there at the same time, and then, you know, so you're with your family anyway. Some people are able to get a job for their spouse there for the, you know, 1 or 2 years that they're going to be there, so they can just take their spouse. But if you have kids, then yeah, tough. So it's the third row.
This one is Austin. I was just wondering if there's is any sort of system in place for continuing education, either
grad school support, or if there's some sort of internal education for like specifically economics and that type of thing.
Yeah, definitely. There are two different types that I'm thinking of offhand. One is that we have what's called the Foreign Service Institute. The full name is the National Foreign Affairs Training Center. It's located in Arlington, and it looks like a small college campus. So basically, if you took maybe this building, Osh, and maybe a couple of the surrounding ones, it looks a lot like that, a lot of green open areas. And you can go there and learn foreign languages. You get job-specific training. You get kind of general trainings like a security overseas seminar, like how to just be safe when you're overseas. So if you need training for your job, they give it to you there. There are also bidding opportunities where you can bid to go take master's courses. I know there's one at Princeton. There's some at the Department of Defense colleges, like the War College. So there are different opportunities, but there's a long list of chances to go on and get some more education. So, and then of course there's an option to take like a sabbatical, take time off from your job if you want to go study something for a while. So I know a woman who did that as well. Yeah.
Hi, my name's Preston. I'm just curious on the A100 in Arlington for the first, like the basic training that first week. What do they do during that time?
Yeah, it's actually it was a 5-week course when I was in it. It's been changed. I know it was 7 at one point. I think it was 6 for a while. So I'm not sure what it is now, but it was 5 weeks when I did it, and it was really kind of a full, kind of overview of everything that you need to know about the department. There's a lot of administrative stuff like human resources things, filling out insurance beneficiary stuff. There's a lot of team building stuff like exercises to kind of come together more as a group. There's a lot of State Department history. Lecturers from different parts of the department come and tell you about what people do, like the Assistant Secretary for Consular Affairs speaks to every class and talks about the visa work because everybody in the class is going to have to do that at some point. So there's exercises in public speaking, in writing, in even in note-taking. Like there was one session where we were shown like a news clip, like a really long kind of public TV-type news clip, and we had to take notes. And then afterwards, the guy asked questions like, well, how many people were there here and all this stuff. So it really is kind of like a full battery of more or less basic overview stuff, kind of what you need to know as a foundation so that the training you get later makes sense.
Okay, and then I just had another quick one.
Mm-hmm.
So you just served your first two tours, which are kind of like making tenure, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what's that process like versus, once you're fully in? Because it's like you picked your career track political, but mm-hmm. you have to do consular in your first, at least one of those first tours. Mm-hmm. But I'm just curious what the change is like.
The principle of being hired as a generalist, which is what we colloquially mean, I can't say that word today, I'm sorry, when we say foreign service officers, is that we're supposed to be generalists, and that is kind of we have this basic set of skills. And ideally, that's what they're testing for in the whole assessment. But you have these set of skills so they can put you into any job that they want, and then you should be able to function. I mean, yeah, you might need some specific training before you get there, but kind of you have the basic toolkit to get it done. So, I mean, I've had, I did my budget work in the civil service, and then I had just a quick brief stint that didn't count as a tour in Tijuana, and then I did IT collaboration tools, so think like Wikipedia and LinkedIn, but internal to the Department of State, so that help people connect and share information. And then I just did consular. So, I mean, it's kind of stuff that doesn't really have anything to do with it, with each other. And I don't know, I don't really feel like it's much of a transition. I mean, you guys, at least I think almost all of you, if not all of you, are younger than me. And so you guys are that generation where you don't want to do the same thing for very long. I mean, I'm that same way. And so you welcome change. You want to do new things. I mean, it would be the same as, taking a different class in college. You finish one semester and you got to go now study whatever it is you need for your general credit that you haven't done yet. So, it's just switching gears, but you can do it.
I'm Dane. This isn't a career question, but I'm just curious because your background. A few years ago, I was at in Mexico, Rosarito Beach, and some police harassed me and took me down to me and a couple of my friends to the station, said they were going to throw me in jail over the weekend and charged us money. Just because of your experience, I'm curious to ask, as an American citizen traveling abroad, what can we do to prevent that, protect ourselves? And in that type of situation, who can we call or what can we do?
Yeah. Anytime that that a U.S. citizen is detained, even if they're a dual citizen or anything, the government of the host country is obligated under the Vienna Convention to notify the U.S. embassy. In practice, that doesn't always happen. So, I mean, I assume most of you at least know about that case of the Mexican national that was executed recently, right? I mean, that was the issue there, was that the Texas authorities didn't notify the Mexican consulate of his detainment. So, you know, I was just in Nicaragua, and the relations between the Nicaraguan government and ours are not particularly warm. So in my experience, they did not hesitate to make things difficult for us where they could. And one of those things was in the notification. So we would find out, like, well after the fact that somebody had been arrested. And they would make it difficult for us to go visit the people. But what you can do on a practical level is, you know, just being situationally aware, kind of know what's going on around you. The fact of the matter is that if an authority in another country wants to detain you, you know, then they can do that. Even if they don't have cause, they have the gun. Like, they're the ones that have the power to take you and put you in a cell or to treat you poorly. So it's tough to kind of avoid that, aside from just maybe, you know, avoiding places that might be a little sketchier than others. But if you find yourself in that situation, then definitely request to talk to the U.S. Embassy, and then, you know, just talk about how that's your right, and sometimes that'll scare them enough that they'll, you know, just let you go. If there's not some good reason that they want to keep you, but yeah, it's tough to, like I said, it's tough to prevent it just because there are a lot of arbitrary detentions in countries all around the world. So,
yeah. We are last question. You mentioned it was easier to get into the department if you've done an internship. How difficult would you say it is to get an internship with the department?
I didn't do an internship, so I can't speak from personal experience on that. But everybody that I've talked to that has wanted to do an internship has been able to get one. So the deadlines are really early because it takes the department a long time to do, like, the hiring process, because even interns have to have security clearances. This is off the top of my head, so forgive me if it's wrong, but I think that to apply for a summer position, you have to apply by, like, November or something. So, I mean, it's really far in advance. And then what happens is each year the Central Human Resources Department kind of sends out a notice and says, hey, who wants an intern? And that comes all the way down to each individual office in an embassy and every office in D.C. And, you know, so offices will get together and say, hey, you know, could we use an intern? Like, what meaningful work could we give to this person? And if they decide that they have something, then they'll hire them. When I was in Nicaragua, just because of the working consular is really heavily regulated, and a lot of that has to be done by an officer, so it can't even be done by the local staff that works there. It's tough to kind of carve out a piece to go out to an intern, so we didn't have any interns there. But when I was in Washington working in e-diplomacy, we had three interns at a time, and I think we had two or three sessions of them. So in 1 year, we had, like, you know, six or nine interns. So there are a lot. And like I said, anecdotally, the people I've talked to, the people I know that have wanted to do internships have gotten them. But I know that there is kind of some competition for it. So I'm sorry, I don't have specific stats on it.
Yeah. Please join me in thanking James Bjorkman for an excellent and informative forum.
Thank you. I did leave some handouts at the back to talk about a few of the different career options with the State Department. So, feel free to take a look at those. I'm happy to answer questions if you want to stick around.